Welcome everybody. My name is Michael O'Brien and I work for Chaos Event, as you can see on my t-shirt. And welcome to the Call of Cthulhu panel. No swords, no wizards, just regular humans in way over their heads as they work to uncover the mind-shattering horrors of the Lovecraftian mythos. That's the promise of the Call of Cthulhu RPG, and over 30 years later, we're still coming back for more. That was an article that was in Gizmodo back in 2013. And that article also asserted you can't really overstate how influential Call of Cthulhu is in the world of tabletop role-playing games. Last year, Geek and Sundry actually had an article that said, it went as far as saying that Call of Cthulhu is unequivocally the greatest role-playing game ever written. We were very, very proud to get that. And I'm pretty sure that the assembled panel of illustrious Call of Cthulhu authors sitting here today would be in very strong agreement with those sentiments. And we are going to talk today about why Call of Cthulhu is such a distinctive RPG and why it still resonates with gamers today, bigger and better than before, seven editions after it first appeared in 1981. But we're also going to try and go a bit deeper in this discussion. Because these days, as we know, Cthulhu is cool. The tentacled one is a popular culture meme. You can see Cthulhu on TV. I'm sure everyone's seen the South Park episode. You can see soft toys. You can see kids' books. Do we have that one here? Booth 829, everyone. And you can even see Cthulhu running for president. I don't know if you saw 2 years ago we had Cthulhu for president up on our website. We had Cthulhu doing this. We had the two candidates down below. Cthulhu's creator, the notoriously shy H.P. Lovecraft, also shares that fame. And his writings, which were never greatly appreciated in his own lifetime and were sneered at by serious literary critics such as Edmund Wilson, who memorably derided Cthulhu as an invisible whizzling octopus, his works are now recognised as seminal masterpieces in the genre of horror. So what was Call of Cthulhu, the RPG's role in all of this? If you speak to some serious literary critics today, you might think not very much at all. Yet others, such as the well-known anthologist and editor Alan Datlow, has acknowledged Lovecraft got a big boost from the Chaosium role-playing game. And other Lovecraft scholars, such as W. Scott Poole, who's the author of one of the latest H.P. Lovecraft biographies, and the novelist China Meevil, will cheerfully acknowledge that their first exposure to the mythos was via the medium of the RPG. Certainly, many current H.P. Lovecraft fans say their interest in mythos literature came via the RPG rather than the other way around. And we'll see if that's the case with many of our panel members here. So that's where we'll start with our panel today. And we'll start with a quick introduction from each panelist. And if you can just briefly tell us what your introduction to the H.P. Lovecraft mythos was. And we'll start with Jim Lauder here.
I'm James Lauder. I've been working in the hobby game industry since the late 80s for TSR and a number of other companies. I'm currently the executive editor of fiction for Chaosium. I started playing Call of Cthulhu in 81 when it first came out. It was a revelation as a game then, and it was also my introduction to the mythos. As a writer, I've gone on and done short stories for things like Shadows Over Baker Street and other mythos collections. I've done some game design for it, but I came to Lovecraft, came to the mythos, came to that wider mythology of horror through the role-playing game first.
Mike? I'm Mike Mason. I'm the Call of Cthulhu line editor at Chaosium. I came to it about late 1982 when a friend at school said, come and look at this. And out of his school bag, he pulled a copy of The Asylum and Other Tales, which was one of the very early Call of Cthulhu adventure supplements, with this fantastic artwork of a proto-Shoggoth done by Tom Sullivan on the front. And went, this looks cool. I went, yeah, it looks really cool. What the hell is this? And so it's this game called Call of... And I went, oh, okay, can I borrow it? And he foolishly let me borrow it, and... Thereafter, I was completely hooked and had found a game that all my life I've been reading horror stories and loved the horror kind of genre, but was playing fantasy D&D because that was what was there. But I've discovered a game that I could actually do what I was passionate about, which was like horror fiction in a game. And that what led me to then read Lovecraft and the circle of Lovecraftian writers thereon.
Great, Paul.
Hi, I'm Paul Fricker. I'm one of the co-authors, along with Mike here, of the latest 7th edition rule set. I'm also one of the hosts of a Good Friends of Jackson Elias podcast about Call of Cthulhu. In the kind of mid-80s, a friend, well, the White Dwarf, the role-playing game magazine at the time, were hosting these Call of Cthulhu scenarios. I didn't know what that was. And then a friend lent me, late one night, a copy of H.P. Lovecraft's story, Pickman's Model. And I went to bed and read that, and it really scared me. And after that, I went out and bought the second-hand box set, and we played Paper Chase and the scenario in there, and never really looked back. And then years later, I met Mike, and he was running a group of keepers at UK conventions, and joined in on that. And you know, that partnership's kind of gone on to many things.
Awesome, Chris.
I'm Chris Bybee. I'm the multi-goal award-winning author. Yay! I came to Lovecraft actually more through the literature. When I was 13, a group of friends and I were at an estate sale, and we had to stay in the house overnight. And one of the books in the house was a Lovecraft book. And so when all my friends were asleep, in the dead of the night, it was just me and my flashlight reading The Outsider and getting incredibly scared, but then not wanting to put the book down. And I moved to the Mountains of Madness. And for me, reading all of that, the greater concept of being isolated and alone resonated with me.
Great. Sam.
I'm Sam Bearden. I'm the lead writer at Meta Arcade. We just put out a Call of Cthulhu RPG adaptation for mobile, which you should all check out. I got my first introduction to the mythos and just Lovecraft in general in college, actually also through the literary side. I was in a zombie genre studies class, as you do, we studied a lot of short stories, and one of them was H.P. Lovecraft, and he heard about a fairly racist, I would say, short story about zombies, and it was something that made me aware that even though this is a fantastical universe, and even though it's an abstracted version of our real world, so we think, so we hope, it has repercussions in the real world, and we have a responsibility to be very careful about those, not only in creating Lovecraft fiction, but in analyzing and taking in what is already there.
You know, I think I'm going to move on to follow on from what you were talking about there, Sam, and maybe you can talk a bit more about this. H.P. Lovecraft was, by all accounts, a racist, even by the standards of his day, such that the World Fantasy Awards recently, a few years ago, stopped using his image on their trophy. So how do we deal with that as RPG writers? Sam?
I talked about this a little bit already, but just to double down on it, H.P. Lovecraft was a guy who was ahead of his time in many ways. He did pioneer a lot of stuff about the horror genre and about science fiction. He created this amazing world that, I mean, we're all here because we like it. But we can also not like certain other things that he created and maybe supported. And it's important, especially as writers, as we go forward and add to this genre, to separate out the problematic, upsetting, and just offensive aspects of the original work and move forward with what was positive about it, and what we are all passionate about, which is like this existential horror. And I think you talked about the loneliness and the feeling of isolation being, I'm queer, and that's something I can relate to. So even though he, you know, maybe he and I wouldn't have gotten along, the things that he created and the things that I gravitate to about them are the things that, the feelings that it creates in people. And that's something I hope that as a writer I can push in my own works.
But at no time as a writer should you ignore the fact that he was an adamant racist. That is something that if you ignore that and try not to acknowledge it, that damages every single person back then and now and their kids. Because while we're doing this and we're writing it and we love it and we're sharing it with other people, if you lose touch with that, then you're erasing history. And we can't do that as writers and gamers. It is up to us to sort of make a difference and change with that. We can see what he did, build on it, and make it better for everyone.
And challenge it. And challenge his, you know, the view that he was presenting.
And you see that in the wider literature and the fiction now with books like Ballad of Black Tom and Lovecraft Country that directly
all
take...
All about...
I was talking about the fiction part of it, but the literary end of it, that is part of what the conversation that's going on in the fiction now is directly confronting this and saying, what does this mean about the larger issues of horror, the larger issues of isolation, the larger issues of perception of the other around you? And it's incredibly worthwhile vein in the work to mine for meaning and for significance in the current audience.
And one of the big things, though, if you're really going to do that, try to tackle that racism or the sexuality aspects of it, is that if you're a cis white male writer, is that you find someone who that story belongs to and you bring them with you and you give them credit and you pay them for their time and help, and they help you do it. Because otherwise, you're stealing someone else's story.
Yeah. I would say, and correct me if I'm wrong, like the sort of least you can do in that aspect is even if you do write it yourself, to bring in a sensitivity reader and just get someone to lay eyes on it and tell you, you know, from their perspective, because maybe you just can't give that perspective. Just to make sure that you're coming at this from a good angle, because it can be easy to lose sight of that when you're adapting this stuff.
And even if you have a sensitivity reader, you pay them. And when approach them, you approach them in a way that's not condescending. I've had people now that put out Home Unbound approach me that I don't know, that never engaged with me before, saying, hey, would you read this for me for free and tell me what you think of it? It's only 80 pages.
Anything else to add there? I'll move on. Okay, so Edmund Wilson had dissed H.P. Lovecraft's writing, talking about the invisible whistling octopus back then.
He hated Tolkien too.
He did. Before the Call of Cthulhu RPG came along, H.P. Lovecraft had died many decades before. How well known was his writing in the mid-20th century? And what did the rest of the literary world actually think about his work? Jim, do you want to talk about
it? A couple of years ago, the Library of America, which is one of these sort of benchmark, this is where the literary establishment says this is an important writer or an important book, did a Lovecraft collection. So it is now fully part of the American literary canon. It has been given the sword, dubbed, okay, you're good enough to be here. When I first came to the material, and when I was reading horror in the 70s, the Lovecraft material wasn't that easy to find. It had been released by Ballantine in the 60s. Some paperback editions lingered. But the most consistent collections of Lovecraft that were available around the time Call of Cthulhu debuted were the Arkham House editions, which were really, really expensive, like $20 hardcovers, you know, at the time, really expensive. And you had to mail order them because no stores carried the material. So what Call of Cthulhu did was bring that material to a wider audience, because at the time, Dungeons and Dragons had exploded. It was establishing this baseline for popular culture access to through Dungeons and Dragons. The books in Appendix N where it was rescuing some of the same lines that had run Lovecraft in the 60s had been the last publications of those books that are listed in Appendix N. And then Call of Cthulhu did the same thing for Lovecraft and the other mythos circles. And because the game was successful and it was consistent over the years, it was a way in which a lot of people were introduced to the material when it wasn't readily available through the literary.
So, Paul, could you talk a bit about how it, Lovecraft's work permeated, say, some film and other areas of popular culture before the RPG?
Yeah, sure. So in the 1960s, we had the director Roger Corman making films such as The Haunted Palace, which was with Vincent Price, an adaptation of Charles Dexter Ward. Many of these adaptations were pretty loose, right? But they did put up Lovecraft's name. Also, we have Die Monster Die with Boris Karloff, an adaptation of The Color Out of Space, and the classic The Dunwich Horror, which curiously kind of added in quite a strong love aspect.
With Sandra Dee and
psychedelia. And the psychedelia, but you know, a lot more love affair than Lovecraft ever wrote, I think, in any story ever, except maybe like between fish people. There was also a band, H.P. Lovecraft, you know, in 1967 with the whole kind of psychedelic movement. And I remember in the kind of early 80s, I was going around secondhand bookshops and sort of fantasy bookshops, and there'd be these little pamphlets, little studies books of H.P. Lovecraft studies. And I was like, what the heck is this? They're like academic journals.
No, the Starmont books. I think Starmont was one of the ones that did those.
Oh, I'm thinking of like a bit later on, like the Crypt of Cthulhu and Lovecraft Studies and Dagon, and these things kind of almost kind of blended into the whole role-playing game fanzine movement as well. Okay. So there's a lot of that, and I think it's interesting to consider. I went to the Tolkien exhibition recently in Oxford, and Tolkien and Lovecraft are contemporaries. They're born within a couple of years of each other, but Tolkien lives until 1973, so if you're a bit older like myself, that's in my lifetime. So you know, that feels, things in your lifetime have a resonance that they feel recent. But Tolkien, of course, died in 1937.
H.P. Lovecraft.
Sorry, thank you for correcting me. Lovecraft died in 1937, so that feels like, you know, ancient history. That's before the Second World War. So, you know, what I consider, what would it have been like if Lovecraft hadn't died young, if he'd gone on to live until the 70s? You know, what would we have seen then? Who knows?
One of the other, the film aspects were generally just dreadful, the adaptations. Are laughable. The better ones, there were two episodes of the anthology TV show Night Gallery in the 70s that did adaptations, and they did a great adaptation of Cool Air. So if you want to see, you know, that's how far down it was actually being in terms of impacting.
I thought you were going to say Professor Peasley's like final lecture.
That it was occasionally blipping up in the popular culture, but not in any way that would be considered major or important.
Yeah.
So 1981 happens, and Call of Cthulhu first edition is published. Sandy Peterson is the author. He's here at Gen Con. I guess he just walked past just before. I guess he had another panel on. So we would all agree here, this is a bit of a Dorothy Dixer question here. I'm sure everybody agrees that Call of Cthulhu, the RPG, boosted appreciation of H.P. Lovecraft and the mythos. Mike, can you talk a little bit about how that happened with the advent of the role-playing game?
Well, I think we've kind of almost said it already. I mean, what the game did, it arrived in people's houses on the gaming tables, and even if you didn't know who Lovecraft was and you didn't really understand what Cthulhu or how to say it was, you know, what it is.
Or spell it.
You understood it was a role-playing game. Hey, role-playing games went in 1981 were cool. Hey, they kind of still are. But it opened the door because obviously it... once you read... You know, we're all... role players have a very common mindset in the fact of we all like to go deeper and explore and change things and break things and rebuild them in how we like them. We're all tinkering and homebrewing stuff all the time. And a part of that is research. And, you know, if you're playing D&D, you started reading more fantasy books because that was a great way to get ideas for designing dungeons and whatnot. Just the same with Call of Cthulhu. And, of course, what really helped with Call of Cthulhu, it came with, like, telling you that there were these books you could read. Once you've read this, you could then go and read all these other things and get all these scenario ideas. So whether you were interested in a fiction or not, you were going to go and read it because you wanted to get free scenarios and ideas. So it kind of spurred people on to go and seek out those, you know, second-hand bookstores, find the paperbacks, find out about Arkham House if you had a bit more money and get some hardbacks or whatever. But as soon as you started to do that, you opened into this wider world and realised it wasn't just Lovecraft. Actually, there was this thing called the Lovecraft Circle. And there was other writers, Robert E. Howard, hey, he wrote Conan as well, and etc., etc. And then you found that people were still writing Lovecraftian stories. And this whole world kind of suddenly opens out to you.
And it's kind of easy access too, because like you said, Chris, you started with The Outsider. I mean, that's like, I don't know, about 15 pages long, probably less. It's a really short story. So a lot of Lovecraft stories, you know, you pick up the thing, you've never seen it before, and it's like, you look at it, oh, I can read that before I go to sleep. It's like real short, then you don't go to sleep.
The other thing that the role-playing game did that was brilliant in the design for it is the game and the system perfectly mirror the larger vector of the mythos, especially the Lovecraft stories. The more you play, the worse it is. So you succeed, and your trajectory as a character is going to your doom.
Which is obviously the opposite of every other role player.
Correct, and that's time. Exactly the so opposite of D&D.
It stood out.
Right, and that's exactly what it was. It became a counterpoint in role-playing to Dungeons & Dragons and the other games that were success-based. The more you played them, the more you developed your character, the higher your level, the more you were rewarded for moving around the world and discovering artifacts and things like that.
And hey, you were playing a normal, everyday, average person, didn't carry a sword.
Right.
So you've sort of preempted my next question, which is, so what is cool about Call of Cthulhu, the RPG? What itch does it scratch that other RPGs don't? And if it didn't exist, would gaming be the same? Chris, do you want to try and elucidate on that a little bit?
It scratches the itch that you're an everyday average person trying to live your life, and you know something, and yet you're moved to try to usually stop it in some form or fashion. You don't have, at its core, any superpowers, any ability to fight it, and you've only got your wits and what little sanity you have to solve a problem. And you're not solving it permanently. At best, you're buying society and everyone one more day, maybe a week, before something else happens. And when you break, you have to hope that someone else steps up to take your place. And there's something about that that is an intrinsically human story, that struggle, that fight.
And I would sort of add to that and say, but I've always found that more heroic than a 10th level paladin running around, because it's easy to be a hero when you're a 10th level paladin, but when you're an average, you know, person dealing with, you know, impossible circumstances, for me that's kind of heroism.
That's true.
Yeah.
I mean, it's about martyrdom, really. Cthulhu is like, the whole mythos is about humbling yourself and realizing that there's no way you can actually win.
Right.
These are forces that you can't even fully comprehend. There's no way you could actually like beat them in like one hand-to-hand combat. There's no way. So it's about humbling yourself and accepting your limitations and moving forward with that, and accepting that even if you die, you know, you die in service of something good.
Right.
I also like the fact that Call of Cthulhu is the only role-playing game where librarians are the heroes. So, when did Cthulhu get cool? Are octoplushies cool? Have we reached peak tentacle yet? Mike, what do you think?
I think there's always room for growth with tentacles. I don't know. There's been, certainly over the last 10 years or so, there's been this constant kind of accumulation of Cthulhu I think it's more, and I think Cthulhu is the right word rather than Lovecraft. I think right. It's Cthulhu that we're talking about here. We've seen it seep in because, I mean, in a purely fictional sense, more and more writers, you can see the DNA of Cthulhu in their work a lot of the time. We see it in Stephen King, we see it in other, you know, popular writers and new writers coming up, such as Laird Barron and so on. But we see it in popular culture. You mentioned South Park, we've had, you know, the Stuart Gordon, you know, Reanimator and From Beyond and Dagon, and we see Guillermo del Toro, and we see Lovecraftian influences in Hellboy. And we have this kind of accumulation that's coming through. And then the internet happens. And it becomes so much easier for people to share their passions and cool things. And here, you know, the collect Call of Cthulhu, you know, here's a glove puppet, a whole video series about glove puppet being silly that look, you know, that's Cthulhu. And it attracts people that have never heard of this, that aren't into horror, but can kind of see the comedy or see the humour, or, you know, they do go down the horror and realise where, you know, and then go backtrack and realise where it's come from. And this just kind of accumulates and builds this kind of consciousness that then begins to just become a steamroller itself into, you know, coming back into gaming, not just obviously through the Call of Cthulhu RPG, but we see it appearing, you know, its influence and its tentacles appearing in other RPGs that aren't necessarily, you know, predominantly horror, but we see them happening, as well as the proliferation of board games. And obviously, you know, there's something in the fact that obviously Lovecraft's work is, you know, is effectively public domain now, so it's a very attractive proposition to audiences.
Right, yeah, and so you, because some of the material has gone public domain, it allows authors to directly answer that work. So you see Kidge Johnson write the Dream Quest of Velvet Bow, because there are no women in the Dream Quest cycle stories as a protagonist, and Kidge says, well, I'm going to write my answer to that.
Yeah.
And one of the things about the nature of the mythos itself that I think lends itself to this, it was originally started and grew very quickly as a story cycle between multiple authors. And they were drawing in other authors as well when they referenced Ambrose Bierce and Robert Chambers and suddenly The King in Yellow and Carcosa, and these things are being pulled in. That established the mythos as a story cycle element that always had multiple voices. Lovecraft is certainly the premier voice for it, but there was room in the mythos very early on for other people, Clark Ashton Smith and the other writers in that circle, to add their voices and their individual visions of what the mythos was. And they didn't necessarily jibe with Lovecraft. A Howard Lovecraft story is not a...
Absolutely.
Howard mythos story is not a Lovecraft mythos story. So that's carried through in the entire trajectory from the start of the mythos to now.
And it's interesting how Lovecraft kind of fostered that. He had correspondence with many of those authors at the time and really encouraged some of the new writers and young writers to, you know, to work with us, his stuff. And he was very generous to them to, you know, to do that.
Yeah. And this goes back to what you were saying earlier. That makes the material incredibly odd because at the same time it is both problematic for inclusion and structurally open for inclusion.
The DNA for that is even within Lovecraft stories themselves,
right,
they're all different protagonists. They're all different, they're all from different perspectives, and it's even in those stories the DNA for that expansion was there.
Yep.
And one of the great things for gaming, I think, and for fiction too, is that all this Lovecraftian world, if you want to call it that, is there's no canon. It's like, you know, you can just recreate those bits. Those bits don't really fit with those bits. Though, you know, so it's very elastic. It was never really meant to all be one cohesive whole. Even, you know, in Lovecraft's own writings, it was never one cohesive whole. It did reuse some themes. But.
And when Derleth tries to force it into that, you know, here's the singular mythos, there's no flex in all of that, you know it's artificial.
Yeah, and that's what we reproduce in the game. It's the fact that it's encompassing and creative, and it has loads of room for that, and that's what is a beauty of the game in that sense.
So is Lovecraftian an imprecise term then? It's thrown around a lot. You see a lot of Lovecraftian games or Lovecraftian themed this and that. Is that misapplied?
It's becoming misapplied, and I think that's a good thing, because that's where the material grows beyond the person.
Yeah.
And the positive things continue on and get picked up by people, and it includes other voices that should have been there all along. There's room for that now, and that's all.
I think we are saying, we're getting to a point where actually the term Cthulhu is actually the term, right? however you want to count it.
The mythos, or
Cthulhuoid, or look, Cthulhu crap, Eldritch crap,
right.
That kind of is, you know, I think, you know, that is what is growing, and the Lovecraft name is perhaps, you know, is not. That's because it's problematic.
And it's sticking around in things like that Library of America book, which, you know, has Lovecraft on the spine the same way it's got Faulkner and Hemingway and Le Guin. And that's simultaneous pressure, but it's in a way that does not forward his biography and who he was. The really racist things he wrote are in print, but they're in print by fascist presses in Norway. The things from the conservative and the really, the worst of his writing is being recognized, but also seen for exactly what it is and not included with the story parts that are worth continuing to celebrate.
So I'm just going to go back to that last part of the question I asked there. Have we jumped the octopus? Chris, what do you think? Have we jumped the octopus?
Not quite yet. We're still climbing up the octopus.
Wait, okay.
One of the books that I'm working on is A Superheroes Versus the Mythos. We're climbing up.
But there is Cthulhu Yahtzee, which is always kind of really...
But at its core, it will still never lose that certain tinge of horror that's always associated with the Boots history. So it'll never completely ever jump the shark. The shark may be redefined as time goes on.
Yes.
I always think of it like this. I could walk into a street, I could ask anyone on the street, hey, have you heard of the film Jaws? And they will say, yes. So you know what a great white is? Yes. Have you heard of Cthulhu? And they will probably go, no. I don't think it's reached anywhere near peak tentacle.
Yeah. You're on the wrong street.
Yeah. Maybe not here.
Yeah.
Maybe not here.
Yeah.
So before we actually go on to having some questions from the floor, everybody here is working on different creative projects, and including myself actually. Can you tell us about the horrible mythos secrets that are lurking in whatever part of the world that you're working on? We'll start with Sam. Tell us what you're working on.
Some secrets, okay?
Speak into the microphone.
Okay, so I'm working on the second campaign for the mobile game we make, Cthulhu Chronicles, and I'm working with a lot of cool writers, some of whom you guys may be familiar with. Chaosium has been a great partner for that, and they're giving us a lot of resources. I'm really looking forward to just getting crazy with the second campaign. The first one, we had a lot of direct adaptations, and the second campaign...
Direct adaptations of what?
Of original scenarios from Call of Cthulhu RPG. And I think in the second arc, we're gonna take it a little farther afield and really get wild with some of these freelancers that we're bringing on.
So, Sam, if someone wants to see Cthulhu Chronicles, where can they do that? Leading question.
In the App Store. Check it out in the App Store. I have flyers up here if you want to come grab them afterwards. We're also in the booth with Chaosium if you want to come by and see it on a big screen. It's a pretty fun game.
Okay, and I'm going to preempt a question that will come from the floor. When's it coming out on Android?
Oh, God.
and from behind the table for those of us with Android folks.
And from within the company.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's a question that I've answered maybe a couple thousand times during the con.
Yep.
Turns out a lot of people have Android devices, and we hear you. I think we're aiming for soon. Is the
good answer.
All I can tell you.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Uh-oh. I understand that could be more like this year rather than next year.
Yes,
is what
this
I understand.
Year. Yeah. Definitely
which
this
is exciting.
Year. Yeah. Sooner than later. It's our first priority right
Correct.
Now. Bear with us.
Okay, Chris, tell us about this tinware you got hanging around your neck. What happened there?
So I wrote a little book called Harlem Unbound, and Chaosium was nice enough to believe in me when I said, hey, I would love to make this a full-on Call of Cthulhu system mechanics with some other stuff. Is that a great idea? And it's going to be called Renaissance, it's going to be Lovecraft, and I'm going to address racism head-on. And there was a pause, and a long pause, and they were like, that is the best thing we've ever heard. And then I picked it up and ran with it. And so the book has been incredibly well-received. It's in 3 or 4 different museums. It's everywhere.
And it's fantastic.
I have the joy right now of working on a project that I am super psyched about for Chaosium.
Uh-huh.
It's a modern-day superhero campaign for Pulp Cthulhu. It gives you the chance to pick up your cowl, battle, shoot energy blasts, maybe a speedster. And having done the full round of playtest, it starts incredibly heroic, and I had everyone by the end of it saying that is the most horrific thing that's ever happened to me.
Nice.
Wonderful. Paul?
Okay, well, I don't know, about 18 months ago, Mike said to me, do you want to join in revising Masters and Arthtep? It'll just be a fairly quick job, which is update the stats a bit, make it work for 7th edition. That didn't play out quite like that, Mike lied. So that turned out to be a pretty massive task, and we're looking forward to seeing that come out in hard copy in October. And we're really fortunate, I think, to have the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society next to the booth this time. This is their first time at this convention, and they do the most amazing props and audio dramas. And they have done a prop set for Master and Arthtep. And if you call by today, you can see Sean Branagh in like the robes that come with the special deluxe version. It's like a priest of Cthulhu.
The special deluxe version comes with the whole high priest.
Yeah,
a whole high priest of Nyarlathotep with the twin scepters, the golden Aztec mirror, and oh.
Andrew Lehman
not included,
though.
Andrew Lehman not included, but imagine if you triple down, he may visit you.
It's unique.
And one of the things about the props I've actually come to realize over this weekend and during this panel with something Chris said earlier and Michael said earlier about the average person being the hero in these stories. The props in these games are anchoring the stories in the real, because they're newspapers that make it seem like this is something you could pick up. It's tailored to the story, but the props aren't bizarro ray guns other than the things that you would stumble on that would tell you the world is not what it seems. Most of the props are things like coins or things that you would encounter
or
in
a mysterious telegram.
Telegrams and things like that, because it helps anchor it directly to that, how the individual that could be like you would get involved in the story.
Agreed, because the first time I ran Mask and I ran it all the way through, I had to make my own matchbox. And I have a player, I ran that 8 years ago, that still comes up to me telling me how great that was. And still has a matchbox because they wanted to keep it.
Now, if you can't quite reach to getting the full prop set from the historical society. Obviously, in the new Mask print, in the book, there is a matchbox and a cup. To make your own again, because obviously we all like to make things.
Because there's that aspect to that anchoring in the real part of the story.
Shall I carry on?
You carry on. I'm just going to say that the rest of my time is taken up with podcasting, as our illustrious friends here, Dan and Chad, will tell you that it takes quite a long time.
So, Masks of Nyarlathotep is currently out in PDF. I think the book tapped out at 666 pages, which we thought was just a coincidence. And then a whole lot of extras that go on top of that. And the physical book is due out, Mike, in...
We're thinking about October, once, shipping and customs and... Yep.
Okay. And what other things can you tell us about?
Given
we've only got about 5 minutes.
We've got 5 minutes. Okay, so last night, Dan Alcatraz won one of the Ennies, which was wonderful. I'm actually currently working on the follow-up Down Darker Trails book, which is called Shadows Over Stillwater, which is more old Western horror. And I'm really excited because one of the elements in that book is a setting that's on the steamboat on the Mississippi, which I think is very interesting and cool. I'm also just putting the finishing touches in terms of the art together for Terra Australis, which is a redevelopment, a reimagining with incredibly a large amount of new material of the very, very old Australia source book for Call of Cthulhu. So that's a couple of things. I've got a Gaslight campaign, I've got a 1920s campaign in Tibet and China and India, all on the way in. I've just received a campaign set in Russia. So I've got lots of Cthulhu coming at me all the time. So it's all cool. So, but yeah, come and find out more, come and talk to me on the booth. I'll be happy to talk about any of this. So.
And Jim?
So I've been working for the last year helping Chaosium put their fiction line to write, and we will be relaunching the line in the next couple of months. We have three books coming out this year. The sequel to the Call of Cthulhu for Beginning Readers, which is an adaptation of Dagon. There will be a third volume of that, which is an adaptation of Mountains of Madness, next year. We have two anthologies coming out this year, one called Sisterhood, which is tales of horror and mythos in women's religious institutions across the ages by all women writers. And The Leaves of a Necronomicon, which tells, it's a round-robin novel edited by Jill Pulver, which tells the story of the unfortunate fates of the various owners of a single copy of the Necronomicon over time. And so all three of those will be coming out. It's a terrific idea for a book. All three of those will be coming out by the end of this year. And then we have some wonderful stuff lined up from what I'm going to hope will be a wide variety of voices, because they're the potential to tell interesting stories with this material. As you see from everything that's being discussed here, there's still a lot of room to do great things.
One thing I want to tell you, Christmas is coming. In October, we'll be launching the Call of Cthulhu Starter box set with a set of dice for people who have never roleplayed before or have never Cthulhu'd before. It's going to be a great Christmas present, so check it out.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk about two other projects that I've been working on. One you may have seen, it's called The Miskatonic Repository on DriveThruRPG, and it's a community content resource. It's a bit like, what's the one for D&D called? The
GM's Guild.
GM's Guild. So you actually can write your own material for Call of Cthulhu, publish it on DriveThruRPG, you can set your own price. Bit of a tip, don't put choose your... pay what you want. Put a price on it, because if you put pay what you want, most people don't pay anything. Put a price on it, even if it's at 99 cents. You can write your own Call of Cthulhu material and put it out to a wide audience. And at the moment, we're getting new things added to that each week. People are playing those things and enjoying them. It's a great way for us to see new and emerging writers and talent and so on as well. So that's on DriveThruRPG. It's the Miskatonic Repository. There's another very secret project that I've been working on. And you may remember back a long time ago, Chaosium had a collectible card game called Mythos, which was a lot of fun. We're looking at doing a new collectible card game, but it's going to be different because it's actually going to be played on the Ethereum blockchain.
Oh, weird.
With cryptocurrencies.
What?
And the game is called Ethernomicon. And it is almost ready to go live. I'll be dripping out some information about this. This is a scoop for this gold Emmy award-winning podcast, by the way. We've never talked about this before.
Right.
Oh, but this is very similar to a collectible card game, except your crypto assets belong in a parallel dimension that only you can access. And we think this ties very, very beautifully to a Lovecraftian theme. So watch out for that one. Okay, we have just a few minutes left for questions, and we will see how many we can get through. First hand was up at the back.
I'm a screenwriter. I have a film created over the West End. So my question is about, you brought up briefly how the movies aren't really great, the Lovecraft movies. Why do you think it's so difficult to, like, closely adapt like a good movie version?
Well, people have done a good version. The guys I mentioned, the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society, have done a 1920s-style silent movie of The Call of Cthulhu, which is really good, and they kind of, you know, it was a 20s silent movie in style. And they've also done Whisper in Darkness, which was a talkie, in a kind of 1930s style. And, you know, there are a variety of films out there more made more recently that maybe on a lower budget, but that have achieved to kind of capture that magic somehow. What would you guys say?
I actually really like the two Stuart Gordon films, in part because they would give Lovecraft fits. they are, especially the second one, actually does directly deal with race and sexuality, because it draws it in and says this is an overt topic of this story in ways that Lovecraft was desperately trying to ignore when he wrote the material. So I think those are clever. They're not necessarily faithful to the tone, but if you look at them as responses to Lovecraft, they're very interesting. And there are some newer indie films that are pretty good.
Thank you, Jim.
Can I get
really quick
at the why? Because I've dabbled in screenwriting. But I think the why is because the whole point of Cthulhu is that it's this existential, unimaginable horror. And as soon as you try to convey that in film, which is, I mean, it's a visual medium. So the reason it's so hard to do is that you have to keep that mystery while at the same time, implying just enough to satisfy the itch of the mythos and to convince people that it is.
What color is the color out of space?
Yeah.
It's very hard. No, exactly. That's why,
Question
John
here.
John Carpenter's a thing.
John Carpenter's
a thing. What is there, if anything, that's still copyright protected, is all of it open to use as Rand's original writing, that is?
Most of his writing is public domain, but you'd have to research individual examples yourself. He did a lot of collaborations, and the way copyright works is life of the author plus X number of years. So if Lovecraft died, his stuff went into public domain in like 2007. If his collaborator didn't die until 1970, that stuff's protected until 2040.
Right.
So it depends on who filed what. It's very complicated. But of the majority of what we think of as the core Lovecraft material, written by himself, is largely public domain.
Yes, question here.
You're talking about other media and upcoming projects, so I've been hearing about a computer game called Cthulhu that Chaosium.
We should probably should have mentioned that, given it's going to be huge. Call of Cthulhu, the computer game. This will be on consoles. It's coming out on October the 30th. The release date was just released. It's set in the classic New England area. The writer that came up with the basic premise for it is Mark Morrison, who was one of the chief writers for Reign of Terror and Horror on the Orient Express. So you know it's absolutely going to hit the mark for being Lovecraftian. Anyone want to add anything more about that?
I think I've seen the screenshots and hear about the gameplay, and I think it's going to be awesome.
So I will say this in terms of getting Cthulhu into the wider world. I follow our social media mentions and likes and things like that, and Call of Cthulhu bumps along very nicely as the RPG, and whenever the video game does something, it does this. So I think that's going to really expose the game. And to the credit of the developers, it's been done under license from Chaosium. They are very upfront about saying, we are trying to emulate the experience you get with the tabletop RPG in the game. It's not a shooter. You don't actually end up with a Tommy gun shooting at Cthulhu at the end or anything like that.
Is it consoles? Is there going to be a PC version?
There's a PC version. It's also available on Xbox 3, Xbox One, and PlayStation, and, PS, and everything else. Yeah. Okay, we've probably got time for maybe one more question. There is one from anyone? Yes, down the back.
So, you guys were talking about how we've reached the point where we're able to critique Lovecraft's racism, classism, you know, all these sort of things. What do you think about critiquing the nihilism that it is kind of built on at a foundational level? Because, I mean, I heard you say it's about sacrificing yourself for something good, which is an interesting thing to say about a game built on a guy who was, like, a deep-seated nihilist. So, talk about that.
In 2 minutes or
less.
So basically, it's interesting, especially because I'm from a younger generation. I'm talking super fast now. I'm from a younger generation where nihilism has sort of become a joke to us. Like the sort of, oh yeah, we're all gonna die. Like it's, we sort of grown up with this idea. So the way that people from my generation and younger generations come at this stuff is, we kind of are fine with it. It's something like, it sounds terrible, but so, like the ideal of nihilism and the idea of sacrifice are not inherently, they're not mutually exclusive to me. I think the fact that, you know, acknowledging that, well, nothing really matters, everything ends, like, you know, like life is temporary, I think that it is inherent to the Cthulhu mythos, and I think that is something that ties in actually really well with the idea of sacrifice, because, well, if nothing matters, well, maybe this one thing can matter. Maybe this is the one thing that I can do, even though I'm a tiny speck of dust in like the unimaginable cosmos. Maybe this is like where I make my stand, so that these other specks of dust can, you know, exist a little longer. I think it makes sense to me.
Okay.
Excellent job.
We could probably talk for hours about these topics. It was wonderful to have so many people come along to join this panel. We really appreciate it. And can we give a round of applause? Please come and visit us if you haven't already at the Chaosium booth, 829. You'll see all of these people there at different times between now and the end of the show. Thank you very much.